Did you learn about money at all in college?
They didn't teach us anything. I took an investing class, which was taught by David Swensen. Outside of that class, I learned nothing about investing. Zero. Honestly, Stacy, I thought at that time that my backup plan was to go and try to be a congressman, you know, and thank God I didn't do that, because what a terrible life that is. I'm too honest to do that. The reality is you don't learn anything about the real world of investing. And when everything looks like a nail, you're going to use a hammer, right? So unfortunately, sometimes you need a screwdriver and you need, you know, a wrench. And but if they don't have that, then they're going to push you to the, you know, they're going to push you to the hammer. And so everything starts looking like a nail. But the reality, though, is, Stacy, I don't think it's like some big conspiracy that nobody wants you to know this stuff. I just think that the incentives are not aligned to make you smarter about your own. It's not to keep you dumb. It's just not to make you smarter. You can't just ignore the game, because if you ignore the game, then you're going to be hurt by the game. Mm-hmm. You, at least if you play the game, you have a shot. And if you play the game intelligently, then you've got a real good shot. I can't make people get money, but I can help them get knowledge. Once the buyers of your currency lose confidence in it, it's over. And then it hyperinflates and you have a complete reset of the system. They made a monumental mistake where they cut off Russia from the SWIFT system, and they seized their treasuries. So what did that signal to the world? It signaled, if you do something we don't like as the United States, we may just seize your assets that include our treasuries. Well, how stupid is that? And the reason it's monumentally stupid is because we need the whole world to buy our treasuries.
No, they don't trust us.
We can't be signaling that, oh, by the way, if you buy them, we may take them back. When one door closes, another one opens, and it did. And I'm very grateful and thankful for the community. And I'm around some of the smartest people I've ever met and ever done business with. That in and of itself makes it all worth it.
When I saw that you posted that you had a chill conversation with somebody for a podcast, I'm like, that's exactly what I want to do. Just have a, you know, a relaxed talk, get to know you. And again, thank you so much for joining me. This is the best gift ever. I saw that you saw my post about it being my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
We're very excited and appreciative of you.
Thank you so much. No, I'm excited and appreciative of you. So thank you for being here. And it's such a great gift to speak with a Bitcoiner and a Wall Street veteran. So I'm so honored. You know, that's amazing. Thank you. I want to get to know you. I saw that you went to Yale and played hockey there.
I did. This is all true.
That's amazing.
Yeah, let's face it. There's no way I could have gone to Yale without hockey. That's reality. And they don't have scholarships there. It's not like I was, you know, it's not like Yale was free for me. I had to take out loans and all that. They just, and you know, my parents got financial aid. We were not a wealthy family, but the way it worked back then was, you know, if you're an athlete, then, and you can do the schoolwork, if you have high enough grades and a good enough SAT score and all that, then you could be recruited. And I was recruited by all the Ivy League schools, and because I had good SATs and good grades and all that stuff. And so they said, well, he can do the work. He meets our threshold, and he could be an impact player on the team. So we're going to recruit him. And so that it gives you that extra thing. Like, so if somebody is a concert pianist or, you know, a Broadway director or off Broadway director or an Olympic fencer or, you know, whatever, those are special things. An artist, a world-class artist, like those are really special things. And so the way they do is they try to build a whole community of these, of people that can help their ultimately help their program and kind of make up a, you know, a slice of the whole world.
Yeah.
And so back then, when this is many, 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 many years ago, I was fortunate enough to be good enough in hockey that they wanted me to be on their team. So
were you, is it something that you were so, I mean, obviously you're so passionate about it because you were that good enough to be accepted by Yale, but did you feel like you wanted to pursue it further? Did you ever think to go pro or anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I thought I was going to do. And yeah, my backup plan was to have a good degree from a good school. Mm-hmm. And so, but yeah, but so the way it works in hockey is a little bit different than things like football and baseball and basketball. In hockey, and probably because it started out as a Canadian sport, really, the way it works is that when you hit 18 years old, you're eligible for the NHL draft. Mm-hmm. So most players are drafted right out of high school here in the United States. So, and then that team gets to own your rights to your team for the next 4 years, right? So, and they expect American players, at least back in the day, and they still do, they expect American players to go to university, go to college, get their four-year degree, and play college hockey, and then, you know, figure it out from there. By the time the draft happens, they already know where you're going to college because you've committed in March or April to the school, and then the draft isn't until June. So mm-hmm. these teams already know, like, if you're going to go play at a high powered program like Michigan or Boston University, and to some extent some of the Ivy League schools, they know that you're going to be in a competitive environment and be able to grow and get ready possibly to play professional. Mm-hmm. So that was a long way of saying that I got drafted by the Boston Bruins in 1989 when I was just coming out of high school. And so they had my rights. And I thought at the time when I was at Yale, I thought that I was getting a degree and getting ready to go play pro. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that didn't really happen the way that I thought it was going to.
So did they lie to you or?
No, I was actually... at the end of my career at Yale, at the last year, it was clear that they were going to sign me and bring me into their program. The Boston Bruins, there was an article back in the day, and it was in the Boston Globe, and the GM was quoted as saying that, or the assistant GM was quoted as saying that they were going to sign two players. One of them was Brian Smolinski, who was a superstar out of Michigan State, and I was the other one. And wow. So I was on my way and that was going to happen. And unfortunately, and I was having a great year. My team was having a great year. We were in the top 10 of all schools in the whole nation. You know, my line had a Hobie Baker candidate on it. Which is, you know, like the Heisman in football. He was, for your listeners who don't know hockey. He was at that time he was the number one all-time leading scorer for Yale. I was in the top 10. It was kind of crazy. It was an awesome moment, and I thought I was hitting on all cylinders. I was strong, I was fast, everything was going right, and I was headed in that direction to go get signed by the Bruins to go play in their program. Maybe not in the NHL right away, maybe in their minors, but and then hopefully build up. But there was just, it just happened like it always does. It's a cliche where I was playing a game. I was playing a game at home, and it was against St. Lawrence. It was just an in conference game. It was no big deal. And I got a breakout pass from my defenseman, and I turned and my left skate got caught in a groove in the ice, and somebody hit me right at the same time. And I just felt it. My knee blew out completely.
No way.
So I was on the U.S. national team at the time, which was kind of, it was like the 21 and under team, which was it was the development team for the U.S. Olympics. And they chose the players off that team. And there was kind of like two full teams of players. And I was on one of those teams at the time. So, and that kind of blew up the Olympics. It blew up my, it basically just blew up my chances to go pro because
did your knee break or was it like,
no, I just blew all the ligaments out. I blew all of them out except the ACL. They said there felt like there was an endpoint there, which meant, you know, back then it wasn't like it is today where they just toss you into an MRI like the next day and figure out exactly what's going on. I mean, this is 1993. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to pay for that and all. It's just one of those things like that Yale wouldn't pay for it. I didn't have the money for it. And right. So, I did the best I could. I healed my medial collateral, which is a ligament that's on the inside of your knee. And so if that splits, because it's skin against the ligament against your bone, it'll push it back together, blood will go to it, and it'll heal. And so that healed, but the ACL just dangles in the middle of the knee. And so if that breaks or if that tears, there's no way to heal it. The only way to heal it is to go in there and stitch it back up. I didn't know how bad it was. It ends up that it was pretty bad. And I just was not the same player after that. I mean, I needed to be 120% of the player that I was to get to the NHL. And now I was like 75 or 80% of the player. And it was like,
yeah, that does seem like a movie. Like when you're,
it's just like one of those, you see it in football movies. It's just like, it was unfortunate. But anyways,
crazy.
That's what happened.
I don't know too much about hockey, but I've been to plenty of Chicago Blackhawks games. And my husband's best friend growing up was the media relations, like president of media relations or something for the Blackhawks. He ended up playing hockey his whole life. And that was, you know, I know so much about it because of my husband.
Yeah.
But he, his friend, you know, he brought us to a lot of games because he worked for that organization. And then now he actually works for the Boston Bruins.
That's awesome.
So it's just funny that you said that because I'm like,
I don't blame them. No, I don't blame them at all. It's just they ended up trading me over to New York. I played with the New York Rangers in camp. But like I said, I just wasn't the player that I needed to be. I was nowhere near. And they went on to win the Stanley Cup without me that year.
No way.
So that was the year that Mark Messier came to New York. And I've got all kinds of stories about
that's
that.
It
was
crazy.
Fun. It was a fun time. Uh-huh. I do, you know, sometimes lament that I didn't get my full shot, but life changed dramatically. And so I was in New York. That's why I was in New York because
if that didn't happen, you wouldn't be on this path that you're on now. And it's such an important path. So it's like sometimes, you know, I feel like it reminds me of this song that I heard called Unanswered Prayers. I think it was by Garth Brooks, but it's like whenever you think that like, why did that not happen? You know, like you're sad about it, but it's kind of because there was a bigger, you know, picture for you or something else, because this is super important what you're doing right now. And I wanted to ask you about that too, like your opportunity fund, but I want to know when you were in college, you were studying political science. Did you feel like it was, did you learn about money at all in college? Because I feel like people that say they went to these great schools didn't learn a thing about money. And was that a class that should have taught about money because of the way politics are tied in with?
They didn't teach us anything.
Right.
The only class, I took some economics classes, and I took an investing class, which was taught by David Swensen, who's the chief investment officer of the Yale Endowment. He's since he passed away, but at the time he was a pretty young guy, and he was in charge of this endowment. He was a cutting edge, CIO, and we can talk about that in a minute. But outside of that class, I learned nothing about investing, zero. And in the political science area, it was all about, I mean, it was literally like constitutional stuff, and you know, it was all about learning the dynamics of politics and how to apply them if you were going to go into that world, in the history of it. So honestly, Stacey, I thought at that time that my backup plan was to go and try to be a congressman, you know, and thank God I didn't do that, because what a terrible life that is. I don't think I'm too honest to do that. So, we don't learn anything. And that's why I set out on this path that I've done the last number of years, is to try to teach people about this world that I live in. Even in that investment world, you know, that investment class I took with David Swensen, it was, you know, it was just a bunch of theory and a bunch of how to look at stocks and that stuff. But the reality is you don't learn anything about the real world of investing and how it really works unless you're in it. And that's the hard part. Yeah.
Even once you're in it too, it's just, you start to see that the people that are doing a lot of this stuff, they're just, I mean, I've talked to somebody recently who was, he had a company that he sold, and a company called Funware, but he had sold to Cisco. So he had like some experience in Wall Street, but he was just saying that a lot of people just play with other people's money, and they're learning about investing by just playing around with money. And they're not really, they don't really know what they're doing, you know?
But that's not untrue. And that's really true in, you know, where you've got RIAs, nothing gets RIAs. You know, they're an important part of the investment community. But you do have some that really just, they don't really know what they're doing. They're just following the advice of their analysts on in their company or whatever. And some of that advice is self-serving to push products that they have. You know, you see it in BlackRock and, you know, some of the big companies, JP Morgan, they'll just push the stuff they own or they're going to benefit from. It's just reality.
But so it's kind of like somebody who doesn't have creativity of their own. They're just following a blueprint from like the guys on top. And they're just like, here, this is what we do. Tell, you know, so yeah. It's nothing where they're just actually smart about what they should do.
Or this is what our company offers. So when, you know, everything looks like a nail, you're going to use a hammer, right? So unfortunately, sometimes you need a screwdriver and you need, you know, a wrench. And but if they don't have that, then they're going to push you to the, you know, they're going to push you to the hammer. And so everything starts looking like a nail. And so that's the thing is that, you know, but the reality though is, Stacey, I don't think it's like some big conspiracy that nobody wants you to know this stuff. I just think that there's the incentives are not aligned to make you smarter about your own investment in investments and your own finances. So then you have to hire these people, because why would Wall Street give away the secret sauce if they're the ones who are getting paid to, you know, deliver that secret sauce to you? They don't. And that's the incentive is just is not to make you smarter. It's not to keep you dumb. It's just not to make you smarter. So that's why it's not really taught anywhere. And it's confusing stuff. This is a really complex and confusing world that we, that I dwell in here. So.
Yeah. And I think my mind always tends to go to like, what are they really doing? What's the conspiracy behind all this? I'm always trying to think, but it's true. It's like, if they're not incentivized, it's just not like they're meaning to do it. They just don't have a reason to change things, you know? So, did you see while you were on Wall Street all those years, like some shady things that would go on? And did you see things that made you question, like, is that what led you to Bitcoin? Like, how did you find out?
Yeah, that's a good question. The answer is, I fortunately was not around that. When I started my career, I was with a British investment bank, really button up stuffy, you know? And I was trading a lot of international stuff, and I ended up going to a hedge fund, that was inside of Travelers Group. Sandy Weil was the head of Travelers Group and ultimately got taken over by Citigroup, or Citibank. And they made it Citigroup from that merger. But so, I mean, no, there was nepotism. There was, you know, insider dealing, but not insider trading. Like, I never saw any of that stuff. We just never, it just didn't make any sense. When you're in an institutional seat, like, these are so difficult to get, these seats, and they're so high paying that it's just astronomically stupid to be, you know, to insider trade. Like, it doesn't make any, the reward is not there, you know? I mean, if you sit in that seat and you continue to do your work and you focus and you do well, you're going to make plenty of money. That's not, so the incentive there, it's really, it's pretty unlikely that you have guys in the institutional seats doing shady stuff like that. Now, would they push it to the edge on tax things or, you know, derivative stuff that they knew that the SEC might not really love? Sure. You know, of course, that's what they do. But shady stuff, like, I mean, you see all this stuff, like the Wolf of Wall Street and, you know, all of the drugs and the women. It's like, maybe it's because I got there in the 90s and not in the 80s, but I just was never exposed to that. And then when I finally got to hedge funds down in Texas, I mean, they were really small. I mean, we had 12 people in the hedge fund that I moved down to. It ended up being over 100 by the time I left. But, you know, and then the next one was really tiny, and then the next one was not very big. So it's just, and it's a really tight community. It's a tight, like, family when you're in a hedge fund like that out in out of Wall Street in a different geographical area. So the answer is, that's another long answer of no, I never really saw that. But the second part of your question is, that what brought you to Bitcoin? And the answer is, No, what really brought me to Bitcoin was realizing just how unfair the system is, mm-hmm. and how that is the answer to bring fairness to the system. Because when I got onto Wall Street, I was all starry-eyed and, you know, bushy-tailed, and thought, this idealistic Yale graduate thinking, well, this is perfect because this is a meritocracy and people are rewarded for the work they do and the focus they have and the discipline they have. And they're going to be rewarded for that in a pure meritocracy. Then boy, was I wrong. You know, the meritocracy is not there. Like I said, you know, there's nepotism, there's insider dealing, and there's, you know, there's a massive amount of greed, and it doesn't translate to perfectly to meritocracy. So, and a big part of that is something that I've talked about quite a bit, is the Cantillon effect, you know, the Cantillon effect, where the money printer ends up, you know, you have a money spigot, and whoever's closest to that spigot benefits the most. And so I realized, as I was digging into really more macroeconomic stuff, that I had done some of that throughout my career, but then I really dug in during the pandemic and started applying all my knowledge there, and realized, God, this system is so unfair to anybody who's not in my seat. It's just wrong. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows anything about what's going on, and they don't understand how inflation is killing them. And
well, that's so nice of you to think when you said, for somebody who's not in my seat, because it's people that are in that position don't care too much about what others, you know, it's more of a selfish system. But for you to take a look at that and think it's not fair, do you think part of that is because you have kids and you're thinking about their future? Or what do you think? Like, it's just nice that you thought about that, and you thought about people that don't have the privilege.
Thank you. I think really it came from the fact that I didn't have a lot of money growing up. I mean, my dad was a nuclear engineer, very smart man mathematically, but he didn't get paid much money, you know. And reality was, we were middle class, like, at best, you know. I mean, like, and he had three kids, and two of them in Ivy League schools, another one in a private university. It was a weight on our family. So we didn't have money, and so I was around those kids. Stacy, I was around the kids who did have money, because of hockey, I ended up going to a boarding school and playing hockey through ultimately kind of like a scholarship there. I mean, they gave me a ton of financial aid to go to a boarding school, to play hockey at Deerfield. And then I go to Yale, Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts.
Okay. I was wrong. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Not Deerfield, Illinois.
Right. Okay.
So I was around that. And I was around these, you know, there was a handful of entitled little brats there. And so I realized, though, how different their lives were, just because there was nothing wrong with having money, absolutely nothing wrong. But the leap to get there was so great. And I realized, as I was leaving Wall Street, I was leaving my hedge fund, I realized the gap is really just knowledge. And that's what it is. I mean, people around me, like, doing like foolish things with their money, but not understanding that it's foolish, and just saying, no, wait, you can't just leave your money melting in the bank. You've got to do something with it. Yeah, but then I risk it. And the point is that the system forces you to take that risk, but you can't just ignore the game, because if you ignore the game, then you're going to be hurt by the game. Mm-hmm. You, at least if you play the game, you have a shot. And if you play the game intelligently, then you've got a real good shot at keeping up. And mm-hmm. sometimes you'll get even more ahead. But God, you've got to keep up. And so, and honestly, what I realized, Stacy, is let's step back. The reason that I even started looking at all this stuff was because I didn't know what I was going to do. There was a pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot of your listeners may have heard this before. I've talked about this before, but just really quickly. During the pandemic, you know, my wife and I were going back in two different cities. She's an author. She's actually a great author, New York Times bestseller, but she could work anywhere. So we had this kind of arrangement where, you know, this is my second marriage. We had kids, but not together. So my arrangement was, we would just go back and forth according to the kids' schedules and my work schedule and whatever. And so, but when the pandemic hit, it was kind of crazy. I had gotten a lot of information coming down the pipe about what was happening because I was sitting in that seat and we have all the information in the world. I was talking to analysts. I was talking to people out in the field out in Boston, where you had Boston Scientific, that conference where people had just got hit with a wave of COVID and it started spreading like really quickly. We had talked to, we actually were talking to Secret Service men who were in the White House and overheard conversations. And they were like, this is what's going on. It was like, wow, this is really scary. So to set the stage, I, you know, my wife was leaving Dallas to go back to Las Vegas. And it was late February, like last couple of days of February. And as we do, we were going back and forth. It was just normal for us. And as we do, she jumped out of the car. She said, okay, I'll see you in 3 days. Cause I was going to go to Vegas, like slingshot or, you know, boomerang and come in after her. And, she's like, okay, I'll see you. And I was like, wait, well, hold on. I'm not being hyperbolic here. Like this could really blow up and I may not see you for a while. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, you're just, you know, you are being hyperbolic. They're not going to like shut down airplanes or airports, you know, you're going to be able to come see me. I was like, just give me a hug and I'll, you know, and I'll see you, hopefully as soon as I can. Mm-hmm. And we literally went to lockdown a few days later and I didn't see her for 100 days.
Oh my God.
So yeah, because I had my kids, she had her daughter. It was a mess. So, oh my God.
Well, yeah. That's crazy because it's true. When you start to see things happening, which kind of reminds you of the same idea you have about what's going on with Bitcoin right now, is you have this, you see what's happening. You have your ear out there. You're hearing from the right people. You know what's going on. But then people that just aren't in that space, they think, oh, you're just being paranoid, or you know what I mean? You're not, but you have that feeling, you know, something's like brewing. And that's just a wild story. But yeah, continue.
So I knew, so once my daughter was, she got into University of Texas, she was leaving. So once I knew that my son was already, he was already in Cornell, he was getting ready to go too. And I never imagined that they would keep the lockdowns going, but they let us move around enough that I, when my daughter was leaving, I packed up my truck, and I left Dallas and I didn't go back. I basically left Dallas and drove out to Las Vegas. And so, literally a week later, maybe 2 weeks later, because I was coming from Texas, my hedge fund opened back up and they said, okay, everybody back in the office. And I was like, I literally just got here. I just got here to my wife. I'd let me work remotely for a while. And so we ended up figuring it out and figuring that, you know, I needed to stay here. I needed to stay with my wife. There was nothing really left for me in Dallas except the job. And so we agreed to unwind my position there. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea. I mean, I had no clue what I was going to do and I had to replace my income somehow. So, my son called me up and he's like, hey dad, you know, I know you're trying to figure out what you're going to do next. And I just think you ought to give this crypto thing a shot, like take a look at it. And I had already dismissed it twice. I dismissed Bitcoin twice because, you know, it's magic internet money and all that.
How old is your son?
So he's 25 now.
Okay.
And so I wasn't, you know, I started looking at that stuff and I started looking at Bitcoin. Eventually, you know, I bought some Cardano and Ethereum and all the garbage. And then, I bought some Bitcoin. And then as I started doing research and listening to Michael Saylor and listening to Preston Pish and listening to Jeff Booth, I finally realized, oh my God, like this is where I need to be. I took all my money out of those other things and put it into Bitcoin and started really focusing on that. And that right there, that is when I realized, oh my God, our system is so skewed and it is so unfair to people who don't have money and don't have knowledge. And yeah. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to get on Twitter. I'm going to start posting about stuff with my experience and maybe that'll help me grow a community and I'll meet more people and I'll find out more about this Bitcoin world and maybe that'll, you know, network and see what happens. And so I started posting things about, you know, like the things that I know, the large macroeconomic stuff about treasury, stuff about debt, stuff about, you know, how these things work, the Fed. And I just started getting more and more people interested and saying, you know, this is incredible. Just keep like, this is awesome. I've never heard this before. And that's when I started that newsletter, The Informationist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I saw that.
And that is really what kind of jump-started my network.
Sure that the knowledge that you have about the macroeconomics and all the global finance in a way that people can, you know, understand, you know, so that's a really great thing that you're doing because you're showing people the problems in the world and why it's unfair and just kind of updating people on things that are happening so that it can lead them to realize what money is.
Yeah, because I can't make people get money, but I can help them get knowledge. Mm-hmm. And if they have knowledge, then it may help them either get money or at least protect what they do have and grow it to keep up with this expansion of the money supply, the debasement of that money. So that was what I realized. I was like, I've got to help these people because they don't realize just how far they're getting behind, especially during COVID when they printed $5 trillion. It was mind blowing. I was like, oh my God. So much money went into the pockets of the 0.1%. Forget about the 1%. The 0.1% made so much money. It was absolutely, utterly mind-boggling how much money they made. And so,
well, and then they say because the inflation accelerates, the money printing accelerates. So what I don't know if this is a correct statistic, but I saw that since then when they printed all that money in during that time, I think in the last 4 years, they printed another $12 trillion and added to the debt. So I don't know if that's true, but I think it's true.
Yeah. So the, you know, the U.S. debt, I mean, that's a little bit different than the expansion of the money supply. It does kind of add to it in a derivative way. But what happens is the government is borrowing, you know that. And so now we have, and I'm looking, well, it's $36.5 trillion of debt basically is what we have right now. That grew, you know, from, and just look at this, just looking at the chart here, grew from 18 trillion at the end of 2015, call it 19 trillion to 2015 to, you know, now 36 point, whatever it is, 36.2 trillion is what they're saying it was at the end of the quarter and quarter 2024, but it's like, it's 36.5 trillion.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling how rapidly our debt has expanded, and that's irresponsible spending out of Congress. It's not the Treasury's fault. The Treasury is literally just enabling Congress to spend. You know,
even Janet Yellen, does she not have access to know where funds are being spent, and she's the Treasury Secretary?
Yeah, no, they see it. They see it from the Congressional Budget Office. So, you know, now it's Scott Bessent, but. You know, she saw what was going on. She was the chairman of the Fed before that. She was the Treasury Secretary. They know all that stuff. Now, what she has to do, her job is to enable it. Her job is to continue to promote the U.S. dollar and U.S. Treasury, make sure that it remains the global reserve asset, the Treasury, then retain confidence in it so that people will buy that debt and enable us to keep spending. Because she knows that our path is a deficit path. And they, you know, the Treasury in her term, the Treasury put out a report. People have seen me post this before. The Treasury put out a report that showed the debt to GDP of the United States, and it was going up in a parabolic line. And she said, the title of the report, the subtitle of the report. It was a state of the Treasury kind of report. But the subtitle of this report and this chart was an unsustainable fiscal path. So, and they put that out for the whole world to see. And, you know, but why would they do that? Why would they do that? Her job is to retain confidence in.
Wouldn't that want other countries to sell off treasuries and bonds and stuff?
Well, it warns them that we are not going to be able to keep doing this forever. But it was really a warning to Congress. It was basically saying to Congress, hey, look, this is the state of the Treasury. This is going to get passed around to your congressional budget committees. You need to read this. we've got to stop this maniacal central spending. We've got to pull these deficits down, because if we don't, this is going to get so far out of control. Our debt's going to hit $100 trillion in, you know, less than 20 years. And so we've got to figure this out now. Mm-hmm. And so there's a big numbers for people to understand, but really the number you should key in on is the fact that we've got 120% of debt to GDP here in the United States. And why is that important? It's important, Stacey, because every single dollar that we borrow is creating fewer units of productivity, real productivity. And that's the problem. You know, so we're getting into this thing that's called the debt spiral, where you have to borrow more just to keep the charade going. And unfortunately, because now we have over $1 trillion of payments on just interest on that debt, that's just making the deficits get bigger, go wider, which means you have to issue more debt, which means that it gets even wider. And so it's troublesome. And it's been like this for a long time. It started back in 1971 when we got off the gold standard, when the Nixon shock, he took us off the gold standard completely. And now there's just unchecked spending in the United States government. Because why? Well, because they can continue to borrow and continue to debase the currency by expanding the money supply. And that's not just money printing. The money supply is expanded through, you know, it's expanded through debt. And so banks and lending and borrowing and all that. So the issue is that there's no real end to it. And that's why Bitcoin is so important to me and all of us, all of our listeners, all of your listeners and our followers, because they're learning about this. And they're like, oh my God, this is never going to stop. And, you know, Lynn Alden's famous line, nothing stops this train. Mm-hmm. Nothing stops this train.
Yeah. And that's why it's so surprising that, you know, it's hard to imagine that when it seems so clear and obvious to you, once you find that out, and it's just, there's a root cause of this problem. You know, people just think inflation is normal, and, you know, they just think, oh, why is everything getting so expensive? And they don't know that there's an answer. They just think that this is the way the world is, and we don't have an option because that's how things work. And we always work. They just think that you're just meant to get, screwed over or whatever. But
And you're brainwashed into that. You're brainwashed into thinking that inflation is normal. I had this conversation with an artist friend of mine. He's a professional photographer up in New York. And we were out to dinner here, and I tried to explain to him about inflation and what, you know, what's going on there and how it comes about. And he just couldn't wrap his head around it. This is a smart guy. He couldn't wrap his head around it because he just inherently believed that you need inflation or else you're not, like, gross productivity is not expanding.
That's what I heard from somebody too. That's like, when I make that argument, they think, well, how are companies or government or, you know, people going to invest in companies to grow the GDP and to make things grow, you need inflation to grow. But I'm like, yes, but do you see the amount of inflation that's been happening? The amount of, you know,
there should be no inflation, right? And that's the point. So, you know, the explosive start to my Bitcoin journey really happened when I was sitting here watching a podcast with, it was Palm, and he was talking to this guy that I'd never seen before, never heard before, this guy, Jeff Booth. And he'd written this book, The Price of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so, I was supposed to be in the kitchen, you know, helping my wife get dinner ready. And I pulled my laptop up, and I sat on the edge of the bed, and I started listening to this podcast, and I just kept listening. I couldn't stop listening. And he was talking about the reality of how the advancement of technology should be deflationary. It should be giving us more goods and services for fewer dollars. Because as the efficiencies increase, then, you know, you're getting more for less. Like, you know, and his famous example is, you can take your phone and you can take, you know, 10,000 photos, You can listen to 10,000 songs or a million songs, you know, and you can have all of that at your fingertips for just a few dollars a month. Mm-hmm. Whereas back when I was a kid, if I wanted to take 30 photos, that was a big roll of film. And not only did I have to buy the film, but then I had to purchase the processing of it. And if I wanted a photo that was bigger than just that little, you know, 3x5 that they give you or 5x7, then I had to go special order it. Now it's like, I can take a photo, upload it digitally. And, you know, so it makes sense that why are things getting more expensive if technology is advancing? It makes no sense. And so he talked about this clash of, you know, the deflationary forces of technology and the inflationary forces of the central banks, and why they need inflation because of all the debt, and why this causes deflation. And these people are having to combat this by expanding the money supply even further.
I was going to just
inflation, more and more inflation. And so, and they inflate assets and that inflates goods and services. And then eventually these are going to clash and the system will break down. And the question then is, what will the system become? And his answer that he leads you to in his book eventually is his answer is Bitcoin. Well, anyways, at the end, my wife is saying, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" I said, "Well, come in. You got to see this." And she sat down on the edge of bed, and we're watching this video. And I said, "You got to see this." And she was mesmerized too. And she's like, at the end of it, and when he explains the Bitcoin, and I looked at her, I said, "That's. Do you see what I mean?" And she goes, "Oh my God, do we own enough?" And so that was kind of that set me off into the, I really got to dig deeper into this.
Yeah. So. And he's got such a way of his calm, you know, his way of speaking and, you know, precise and just very to the point. Like he knows how to just not feel like he's yelling at you or telling you something to force you to do something. He's just explaining how the world is getting shaped up. And that really affected me too when I heard about the deflationary forces of technology. When I heard podcasts about him talking, I've read his book, and he is very forward thinking in that way. And he's orange pilled so many people, and he's helped people understand the way things are changing. And I think when you said those two things are going to clash, that part, it was crazy to me because I've also heard that as much as inflation is a scary thing for the world, for governments, deflationary, I think they're more afraid of deflation than inflation, right? So is that why they're just like pumping this, you know, world full of money? Because they know that eventually these things are going to...
Well, think about it. If we have deflation, we allow deflation, okay? Just let's talk about the United States. $36.5 trillion of debt. If we allow for deflation, our $29 trillion of GDP annually will fall. And so let's say it falls 10% or 20%. Now you're talking about 20 to 22 or $23 trillion of GDP. Well, the US government uses taxes and fees and, you know, import fees and all of that, tariff fees to pay down that debt they've borrowed. So if the debt is still rising because of the interest rate that's on it, and the, you know, they've got to continue to, you know, they're borrowing. Well, what happens? It ends up that they have to borrow more because they're getting the fewer tax dollars while this debt is still growing, and even fewer tax dollars, and this debt grows even steeper, and even fewer tax dollars. The debt. So you can see it becomes this problem that they can never pay down the debt. Like it gets to be the point, it will get to the point, and it'll happen in other countries before it happens in the United States, because we do have the benefit as the United States of having the global reserve asset in the treasury and the global, which is because the dollar is the global reserve currency. Mm-hmm. And so people use, they buy treasuries. So they have basically dollars on hand. So they can sell the treasury and have dollars. So, you know, but there will be other countries, and you'll see that this happen in the next decade, that just can't keep up, and they'll collapse because their debt gets to be too big and people lose confidence in that debt. They stop buying it. that, you know, so the government will have to print more money and the inflation goes higher and it just becomes a big mess. They wind up losing confidence in the currency. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, it's over. Mm-hmm. Once the population, a population or, you know, the buyers of your currency lose confidence in it, it's over. And then it hyperinflates and you have a complete reset of the system. And so often the reset of the system of those smaller countries is to go on a dollar, on a dollar denomination. And so, mm-hmm. and dollar standard, a US dollar standard. And they have to, because they can no longer issue debt in their own currency. They lost that opportunity. It's gone. And so that'll keep happening. And this feeds into the, Brent Johnson's of Santiago Capital, his dollar milkshake theory, which is basically every currency just begins to fold into the US dollar because the dollar is so strong that it, you know, as it gets stronger, even if we have problems, it's creating problems for other countries because of the euro dollar system. And it just becomes this cycle where it gets worse and worse and worse for all these other countries first, and then eventually it'll hit the United States. I don't know when. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's tomorrow. I don't think it's this next couple of years, you know, but who knows that.
Yeah.
It's accelerated.
That's why I think that they just don't mind printing, because they know that they're just going to bring other countries all to just have to use the dollar because they have no choice. And then eventually that deflationary force will hit that'll just kind of like stop it in its tracks, maybe. And they know that technology will just, this AI boom that we're going to be seeing and we're already seeing, and the advances in, you know, productivity with robotics and all that stuff is going to just increase so much that that it will just kind of like flatten things out. But at the same time, if it wasn't for Bitcoin, I feel like I don't know what the world would look like as this continues to happen, because it would just end up being like a very dystopian future. Mm-hmm. That's what I just think and that's why I'm happy that there is an answer. There is Bitcoin.
Yeah, then that's it. That's a hope. Bitcoin is literally hope because of that. Right. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And it will level the playing field. That's why I love it. It allows people to store their hard earned energy without having to spend it immediately to get the full value of it. And, mm-hmm. Or vice versa, you know, put it into something like the US dollar or the euro or, you know, whatever it may be that loses value every single year. I mean, it's funny because I've been to Europe and I've got, you know, euros in a safe, and it's like, why would I have euros and pounds sitting in a safe? Like, I guess there's no way for me to really invest it, but that few hundred bucks or whatever just gets worth less and less and less every day it's sitting there. And, you know, it's kind of visually representative of the reality.
What do you think about even like, just the thought I've had once I saw that, you know, after everything happened with COVID, I was around the same, it was the same time for me where I started to realize things and seeing how that was all playing out. And I don't know what your take is on this, but my idea about there being a global financial war that we're witnessing happening right now, it just feels like there's all these forces fighting. But knowing that when the Russia-Ukraine war started, it felt to me like it was kind of Russia's way to say, okay, we know you've just printed an astronomical amount of money during COVID. Now, if we start this war with Ukraine, you're going to have to spend all this money you don't have to continue to fight us. So it was almost like a checkmate situation, because it's like either we win and we do what we want, or you fight us and keep spending more of your money and debasing your currency. So I kind of felt like Russia was like, I don't know, that's my idea about that.
Yeah. I think they saw a window that I don't know how I can't get into Putin's head. You know, this is a, you know, like him or hate him, which not going to get political there.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to, but I just think it's just
obvious,
interesting.
It's obvious he's not been a great man, but you know, he's a smart guy. He's a genius. And he's a genius at power plays. And so I think, honestly, he saw that we had a weak administration. You know, Biden was barely hanging on physically at the end of his term. And so I think he saw that and you saw this window of go attack now before the next administration comes in, because who knows who it could be. It could be Trump again. Who knows? And I don't want to deal with that guy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, or I'm not going to be able to wage a war with him in office. He'll go nuclear on me, whatever. Right. So the big mistake there, Stacey, and why, how this all, this financial, you know, war started and all the things that are happening there, it's kind of twofold. It's what you're saying is the other countries recognizing just exactly what we're doing with our debt and how we're expanding the money supply so rapidly. We printed $5 trillion. It's been awful for any holder of our debt. It's been a negative real return for a decade, you know, decades, you know? And so, I think that's part of it. The other part of it is that we did that really stupid thing where, you know, the Biden administration, you know, they made a monumental mistake where they cut off Russia from the SWIFT system, which is our payment, the global payment system.
Oh yeah.
And they seized their treasuries. So what did that signal to the world? It mm-hmm. signaled, if you do something we don't like as the United States, we may just seize your assets that include our treasuries. Well, how stupid is that? I mean, it's just monumentally stupid. And the reason it's monumentally stupid is because we need the whole world to buy our treasuries.
No, they don't trust us.
We can't be signaling that, oh, by the way, if you buy them, we may take them back without any recourse. I mean, that's just crazy. So, or dumb. Or financially suicidal. But that's the problem. So now we hear rumblings from the BRICS countries, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, that they want to have a way to have cross-border payments for goods and services, and likely for commodities like oil and things like that. They want to have a system where they don't have to use U.S. dollars. Now, a lot of people are saying, "Oh, the BRICS are going to try to come up with a competing currency, another global reserve currency." And I don't think that that's really true. I just think that they want to get away from the dollar, so they don't have to be beholden to holding these treasuries that could get seized and that are definitely being debased in front of their eyes, or negative real return. So that's what they're doing. They're exploring ways to do that, and they continue to explore the ways to do that. And that's troublesome. Why is that troublesome? Because we're seeing the demand for U.S. treasuries drop globally. And they're not having international buyers like we did before. And so it's a little bit confusing when you look at the auctions, the treasury auctions. There's a line that's an international line, and the problem there is that a large percentage of that international line that you see every single auction, a large percentage of that is actually U.S. based hedge funds that have offshore entities that they're buying through the Caymans, you know, or the Bahamas, typically the Caymans. So it makes it confusing. But the reality is that the international demand from like China and other countries has dropped. And so that's a problem. It's a problem because we need everybody to buy our treasuries. And so this has been kind of a long time coming, and now it's accelerated, and now it's really heated because it's been exacerbated by the Trump tariff war that he's created. And so mm-hmm. now you've got countries that are like, well, I don't want to hold treasuries with where the dollar's going, you know, like I need something that is going to hold value for me. And I definitely don't want treasuries. And in fact, if I need more dollars because of all these tariffs, I'm going to have to sell treasuries to have them. And mm-hmm. so it's just accelerated this problem. It's growing.
Yeah. And when I talk to a lot of people who, you know, I'm a hairstylist, so I see a lot of real regular people, you know, in the real world that just talk about the way things are going right now. And when I describe that sort of situation, a lot of people just, they're so stuck on the thinking that everyone needs U.S. treasuries, like people need them, and they're still buying them a lot. And I'm like, I don't think they are. I don't think that they want U.S. treasuries the same like they used to.
The international buyers don't, but they, you know, pension funds and endowments do. Mm-hmm. They have a mandate of how much they need to own, basically, and they're going to own them. And so what's happening is you see every single time one of these bonds mature, the money goes back to the owner, and then they turn right back around and buy what? Treasuries with them again. So it's like, you know, they do, it's just like they just keep buying them. And so
why do they have to? Is it who's making them like have the mandate to do that?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, pension funds, they have future obligations. They know what they are, and they have this mathematical calculation they use that is a mix of assets, and it's a mix of typical things like stocks and bonds, and not just treasuries, but you know, they'll have corporate bonds, they'll have AAA all the way down to just what investment grade, and they'll own other things too, like they'll own alternative investments like hedge funds or private equity or venture capital, and they have these buckets. And the way they do it is they'll look at their whole portfolio of all these assets. The chief investment officer will look at all the portfolios and all of the different portfolios that their sub managers are running, and they'll look at it holistically and say, now my risk, you know, is a certain level and my return is a certain level. And for many years, bonds brought down the risk of your portfolio without decimating your returns. It just brought it down a little bit. So now, you know, that's just, they have that as a bucket, and they're not going to just get rid of that bucket. Like, that bucket's there. And so maybe it gets smaller, maybe it gets bigger. But when you have situations like we have today where there's a push and pull about whether or not long-term rates are going to go down or up, the bet is they're going to go down. And so what does that mean? That means that they're going to want to buy more to get ready for those to go down, because it'll give them a better rate of return than just the coupon on that, mm-hmm. on that treasury. And, you know, but these are long-term holders. They know what that rate will be if they hold it to maturity. And so the likelihood of the U.S. defaulting on a treasury is, you know, it's a non-zero probability, which is close to zero as you can get. And the reason for that is that why would the treasury ever default on a bond if they could just team up with the Fed, print money and buy them themselves? Of course they wouldn't. So they wouldn't do that. They'll just debase it every day and soft default.
Do you think anything is going to happen going forward with the Fed and, like, you know, Jerome Powell, like Trump getting rid of Jerome Powell or anything like that? Do you think that?
No.
Never?
I see. Look, Powell wants to be Volcker. He wants to be the guy who saved the U.S. from hyperinflation, not hyper, but, you know, massive inflation like we saw in the 80s. He wants to be that guy who came in, tackled it, conquered it and won, and then leave office and he's done. You know, that's what he wants. He wants to have that as his legacy. He's not going to sit here and listen to Trump telling him to lower rates when he is worried about the legacy and worried about, you know, a flare up of inflation again. If you look at the chart of where inflation has come from, then you overlay it on the chart of the 1970s and 80s, they're like almost, it's incredible how closely they follow each other. And so the spike of inflation back down to the leveling out. Now, not the same exact height, but the same path, right? So, you know, the worry is that he doesn't tackle inflation properly and it flares back up and gets out of hand again.
And he's probably also at the point where he thinks the legacy that he would leave behind wouldn't just be your regular old spike like back then. It would lead to maybe the hyperinflationary point where people are like, this is the moment in history where everything went completely out of control and he's responsible.
And he's the one. Yeah. And so he certainly doesn't want to be that guy. And so he's willing. And here's the quote. He said, I would rather err on being overtight because we have tools to combat that in the other direction. They've found how difficult it is to combat inflation that rages out of control. It's a wildfire that's very difficult to control. And so he doesn't want to have to come out with a money bazooka. I mean, I'm sorry, he doesn't have to come out with the, fire extinguisher. And it gets messy trying to put out, because then it's like, well, I got to kind of put out the whole fire. And it really is difficult to time a landing like this and to, you know, and to control that fire extinguisher. On the other side, he's like, well, look, if it gets to be too low, and you know, the expansion of the economy is, you know, contracting instead of expanding. Well, what we can do is we can print money, and we can kind of spur that that economic engine again, kind of spark it. And so it's easier to light a little fire here, light a little fire there, light a little fire, get things going again, you know, fan the flames. That's easier to control than this thing that might rage out of control. And so that's mm-hmm. what I think he's thinking. And so he said, you can hear him. He says it. He says, we have tools to deal with that. If we err on being too restrictive, we have tools to deal with that. It's a direct quote of his. And then, mm-hmm. You know, and he's also said he's data dependent. And the reality is we've seen a lot of data here that's been kind of, you know, conflicting. And it's just now getting more and more and more on the side of recessionary kind of data. And so he's waiting to the point where in the unemployment rate gets to a level that, okay, I gotta help with this now, because inflation's mm-hmm. still not at 2%. But when the unemployment rate spikes up, then he starts getting worried.
So does he have a term where he can have this position as long as he decides until he retires? Or is there some sort of...
His term is up in 1 year.
Oh.
In the spring of 26. So, okay. But he, you know, yeah, and he has to be reappointed. So...
But can he be reappointed, or he can't?
Yeah, yeah. Trump could reappoint him again if he wanted to. I don't know why he would do it, though. It sounds mm-hmm. like the most awful job in the entire world.
I know.
Thankless, and I wouldn't want to be him. You know.
Yeah, I feel like all of us look at him and they're like, ooh, like, you know, because every time he speaks, we're all like, what is he going to say today? But mm-hmm. most people don't see him on the street and know that's Jerome Powell. But I guess all the Bitcoiners kind of know about him.
They do.
Gosh, yeah, that would be terrible. I feel like even Janet Yellen or like all these people, I feel like I wouldn't want to be in their position. It's like,
no, it's a binary feeling for those people. It's, you know, so.
So I wanted to ask you also about your opportunity fund. So you started that in 2023. So can you tell us about what that is?
Sure. So the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund is it's an investment partnership. It's a hedge fund. And we invest in both public and private companies in the Bitcoin space, only in the Bitcoin space. So any company that we invest in has to have some sort of Bitcoin aspect to it and exposure to Bitcoin in some way, shape, or form. Stacey, we focus the way it's different, though we're doing public and private investments, is number one, we focus on investments that or companies that are a little bit more mature. So we like to say that they're real companies with generating real revenue and real profits. And so that's kind of our core. And we have a lot of public investments because of that. And we can also hedge because we're a hedge fund, which takes out some of the volatility of Bitcoin. Not all of it, because we are on a Bitcoin standard. So whatever cash we have is really in Bitcoin. It's not in US dollars. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, those private investments, we will do some early stage stuff. But we are more apt to do something that's a Series B, Series C or something, or just a pre-IPO opportunity. So
do you invest for anybody or?
Yeah, that's a good question. The SEC rule for a partnership like this is that you have to be an accredited investor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to make a certain amount of money and you have to have a certain number of assets to be able to invest in it. It's not my rule. I hate the rule. I wish everybody could invest in it just for a few bucks, but there's nothing I can do about that.
SEC rules.
Yeah. So, and so that first fund is closed. It's done very well. The first year, we were open about five quarters and we returned 85% net to investors. That's after all fees and everything. So that was awesome. And so we turned around and launched fund two. The difference here is that fund two remains open. So it's going to be an evergreen fund where, you know, investors can invest at any point in time or they can add to their investments. And we did that because the first fund, two things. The first fund, we had a lot of investors saying, oh, can I add to my investment? It's like, no, you really can't. It's closed fund. But we'll launch another fund that does the exact same thing. And all we do is allocate between funds according to how many assets are in the funds. So we're doing the same investments. And so that fund just launched. We've already raised about 20% of our goal, and we're excited about that, even in this really difficult period, which is, it's been difficult. And but the difference there is, unfortunately, because of the nature of accounting, if you're not in the fund, if you're not an investor in the fund at the time that we do a private investment, then you're not going to get that private investment. It's only for the investors that are already in the fund, and then it gets side pocketed. That's just because of the accounting of the fund. But yeah, and we've got some exciting stuff brewing, and we've got some great private investments that we're working on right now. And, you know, we're giving investors a chance to come in before we do those. But
and you did, when you said 85% returned after all the fees and everything, it's like, to do that at a time where you launched in 2023, it was a terrible time in the markets, and for you to be able to do this,
to gather money, it was so difficult. It was so difficult to gather money because nobody wanted to touch Bitcoin. We just had the Sam Bankman-Fried fraud and the Celsius and FTX debacles, and it was a disaster. So we're happy that we got out of the gates. We raised less than we wanted to, but we're doing really well with it, and we're excited. We're super excited about the future of Bitcoin, that's for sure.
Yeah. So this is definitely even a more exciting time, especially knowing that you did what you did during a terrible, kind of horrible time. Yeah. So congratulations on that. That's incredible. So yeah, it's a great future to look forward to. I feel like your job now compared to before, when you were working with the hedge funds and you lived in Texas, you must feel like, even though you're probably, I'm sure, super busy, you're always showing up doing podcasts, you know, thank you again for being on mine, but I'm sure the feeling you have from being so busy, doing these talks and doing the investment the way you want to do the investment is probably just so energizing and like makes you so happy, you know, to be in a part of the world where you can help, you know, people do better.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, if this wasn't so rewarding, I would be completely obliterated by now because of all the energy it takes, but I get a lot of energy back and it's good. And it's exciting. Every morning I wake up and looking at things and trying to decide how to position ourselves, and it's fun. It's a fun world for me to operate in. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. That's so incredible. I mean, thank you for everything you're doing. And I'm just still, you know, I think it's amazing that you were in that entire world and you had your, you know, insider kind of information, like where people normally don't know the stuff that's going on in finance, and for you to just think about how unfair it is really refreshing to hear that that's how people can just get out of it, you know, even though you're there and you see everything and you could just ignore it and just live your life, you know, but you're just, you know, plus it's like the whole story of you being apart from your wife for that long of a time. And then wanting to finally get there and be with her, and then you're pulled back to work. It's like that was just such a meant to be kind of moment, because it just helped you realize what's important and where you should be, and just kind of like upset you that you had to go back and after all of that, you know, hell that you went through. So that's just like really, really timing was right, you know, so to help you want to get away.
Yeah, it was definitely helpful. It definitely, it pushed me, you know, when you have, when one door closes, another one opens, or whatever the saying is, a window will open or something. And so, and it did, and I'm very grateful and thankful for the community. And, you know, I'm around some of the smartest people I've ever met and ever done business with. And that is, that in and of itself makes it all worth it.
I know for sure. Do you have like a whole busy rest of your day now? Or are you going to be just like interview after interview?
I turned around. I have a meeting in 4 minutes.
Oh, and, no.
and then I'm on my way for the rest of the day, just doing hedge fund stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'll let you go since you have 4 minutes left. So get a little break, but thank you so much for joining me. This has been incredible.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And
you made my birthday.
And happy birthday. And for anybody who does want information about the hedge fund, you can find it at bitcoinopportunity.fund. You know, it's that right there.
Yes, awesome. I'm going to link it. Yeah, there you go. I can see it better now.
Yeah, so it's bitcoinopportunity.fund. You can just put your information in. We can talk to you if you're interested. But Yeah. And I really appreciate being here on your birthday and you spending your birthday you. Working in the Bitcoin space. It's awesome. And I look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Have a great day and enjoy the rest of your day with your other meetings and your important work.
Thank you, Stacey. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.